But anyway, what I want to do is I want to pick up where we left off at Psalm 76 is where we left off. In the book of Psalms, beginning with verse 1 of Psalm 76, it says, God is known in Judah, His name is great in Israel. His tabernacle is in Salem, His dwelling place also is in Zion. There He broke the flaming arrows, the shield and the sword, and the weapons of war. You are resplendent, more majestic than the mountains of prey. The stout-hearted were plundered, they sank into sleep, and none of the warriors could use his hands. At your rebuke, O God of Jacob, both rider and horse were cast into a deep sleep. You, even you, are to be feared, and who may stand in your presence when once you are angry? You caused judgment to be heard from heaven, and the earth feared and was still, when God arose to judgment to save all the humble of the earth. For the wrath of man shall praise you, with the remnant of wrath you will gird yourself. Make vows to the Lord your God and fulfill them, and let all who are around him bring gifts to him who is to be feared. He will cut off the spirit of princes, and he is feared by the kings of the earth. Now, so it's only a dozen verses, but who could tell me in a nutshell, what exactly is this psalm dealing with?
God's judgment.
Well, be more specific. Right, this is dealing with the second coming of Jesus Christ and his millennial reign. This is what this is dealing with. This is a prophecy in regards to his return. And, you know, I think we're getting closer and closer to that day. And I'm certainly not setting any dates, but Jesus Christ did pinpoint a time in history and a number of things to look for that would signal his soon return. And I'll tell you what, the Psalms, they speak of Jesus Christ backwards and forwards, and they just speak of him continuously and constantly. And if you could put this in context, if you realize, well, this is talking about his return. This is talking about when he sets up his millennial kingdom. This is talking about when he arises in judgment to judge the world and to really do away with the wicked. You know, once you have that set in your mind, then go down and break it down, and it really begins to come alive. At least it does in my mind. At verse 1, it says, God is known in Judah, His name is great in Israel, His tabernacle is in Salem, His dwelling place also is in Zion. Now, just that alone, it would have to tell you that when is this going to take place? When it says, God is known in Judah, is Jesus Christ known in Israel today? By the Jews as their Messiah?
No.
No. I mean, yeah, there are some Jews, a remnant of Jews who have given their life to Jesus Christ, but the overwhelming majority of the Jewish people today, God's chosen people, they have rejected Christ as their Messiah, but they are, before it's all over, done and finishing through, there's going to be a remnant who are going to give their lives to him, who are going to cry out to him, and are going to recognize him and acknowledge him as their Messiah, as their Savior, as their God. But this has not happened in the past, and it's certainly not happening today. But it's saying, God is known in Judah, His name is great in Israel. That's going to be when He comes back and sets up His millennial kingdom. And He's going to be ruling and reigning in Israel. All right, and the whole world is going to be filled with the knowledge of God. And all the nations of the earth are going to stream to Jerusalem where Christ is ruling and reigning. Because and it says this, His tabernacle is in Salem, His dwelling place also is in Zion. Now, what does that mean? What's Salem?
Peace.
It means peace, but what is it?
Jerusalem.
It's Jerusalem. And I think it's very interesting. You go all the way back to Genesis 14, and also we read about it in Hebrews, about Melchizedek. You know, we read about the situation with Abraham returned when he had Lot and the people of Sodom and Gomorrah were captured by these various kings of Mesopotamia, and Abraham led out after them, and then he returned with all of the spoils and with all these people who were captured. And it says this in Genesis 15, then after his return from the defeat of Shalom-Lamor and the kings who were with him, the kings of Sodom went out to meet him at the Valley of Shaveth, that is the king's valley, and Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. Now he was a priest of God the Most High. He blessed him and said, blessed be Abraham of God the Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God the Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand. Now this was Melchizedek, and we read about him in Hebrews, where the author of Hebrews, who I believe was the Apostle Paul, He talks about this Melchizedek when he said this in Hebrews chapter 7. For this Melchizedek, king of Salem, and we're just reading now of Salem, right? Salem is the ancient name for Jerusalem. But Salem means what?
Peace.
Peace, all right? For this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest to the Most High God, who met Abraham as he was returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him, to whom also Abraham apportioned a tenth part of all the spoils, was first of all, by the translation of his name, King of Righteousness, and then also King of Salem, which is King of Peace. Now, this Melchizedek was a prefigurement of Jesus Christ, because we are told in Psalm 110 that Jesus Christ would be a priest forever of the order of Melchizedek. Because there were, what was the priestly tribe? What was it?
Levites.
It was the Levites. All right? Well, Jesus Christ came from what tribe?
Judah.
So right. Therefore, as coming from the tribe of Judah, he would have been disqualified as being a priest. But he's of a totally different order. He is from the order of Melchizedek. And then the writer of Hebrews says that this Melchizedek, we know nothing about him. We have no idea of his genealogy. Where most prominent and important figures in the Old Testament, you could always trace their genealogy. Well, he was a type of Christ, all right, in the sense that he had no beginning or no end. Now, believe me, Melchizedek was a man, and he did have a beginning. He did have a mother and a father and a beginning and an end. But the very fact that we don't know any of these details prefigures him as Jesus Christ. Now, I just read it there. What does Melchizedek mean?
Righteousness.
Righteousness. Very good. Somebody was listening. And then Salem means peace. So Jesus Christ is a king of righteousness, and he's a king of peace. When he's going to be ruling and reigning, guess what? He's going to be king, and he's going to be priest. He's going to hold these two offices. There's not going to be any of this separation of church and state and all that's baloney. Christ is going to be ruling and reigning in this world as priest and as king. So that's why when you just go back here, what we're reading here in this Psalm 76, it says in verse 1, God is known in Judah, his name is great in Israel. That's not going to happen until he returns with great power and great glory. His tabernacle is in Salem. In other words, this is where his temple is going to be. This is where he's going to dwell for 1,000 years, as in Jerusalem. And his dwelling place is also in Zion. Zion is another word for Jerusalem, or God's people, or the Jewish people as a whole, right? And it's just another name for Jerusalem, the city of God. Then it says that, verse 3, there he broke the flaming arrows, the shield and the sword and the weapons of war. Now, what is that talking about? What is it referring to?
Spiritual war.
Well, yes, I'm talking about Jesus Christ here, that verse 3. There, he, Jesus Christ, broke the flaming arrows, the shield and the sword and the weapons of war. Now, what is it talking about there?
That he brought peace.
Armageddon.
It's talking about Armageddon. It's talking about the end of the world. It's talking about his return. It's talking about what he's going to do when he returns with great power and great glory, and every eye on earth is going to see him. And I'll just give you some examples, but there's no way I could cite them all because there's way too many. All right, there's over 1,000 references in the Old Testament in regards to Jesus Christ's return. There's 325 references at least in the New Testament in regards to his return. But I'll give you an example. In Joel chapter 2, it says this. It says, I will display wonders in the sky and on the earth, and blood and fire and columns of smoke. The sun will be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the great and awesome day of the Lord comes. And it will come about that whoever calls upon the name of the Lord will be delivered. For on Mount Zion and in Jerusalem there will be those who escape, as the Lord has said, even among the survivors whom the Lord calls. In other words, he's going to return to Jerusalem. He's going to set up his millennial kingdom there. But it also goes on to say in Joel chapter 3, for behold, in those days and at that time I will restore the fortunes of Judah and Jerusalem. And we're just reading about that right here in Psalm 76. And I will gather all the nations and bring them down to the valley of Jehoshaphat. Then I will enter into judgment with them there on behalf of my people and my inheritance Israel, whom they have scattered among the nations, and they have divided up my land. And it goes on to say in this Joel chapter 3, it says this, proclaim this among the nations, prepare a war, Rouse the mighty men. Let all the soldiers draw near and let them come up. Beat your plowshares into swords and your pruning hooks into spears. Let the weak say, I am a mighty man. Hasten and come down, all your surrounding nations, and gather yourself there. Break down, O Lord, your mighty ones. Let the nations be aroused and come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat. There I will judge. There I will sit to judge all the surrounding nations. Put in a sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Come and tread, for the wine press is full. The vats overflow. For their wickedness is great, multitudes and multitudes in the valley of decision. For the day of the Lord is near in the valley of decision. The sun and the moon grow dark and the stars lose their brightness. The Lord roars from Zion and utters his voice from Jerusalem, and the heavens and the earth tremble. But the Lord is a refuge for his people, a stronghold to the sons of Israel. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God dwelling in Zion, my holy mountain. So Jerusalem will be holy, and the strangers will pass through it no more. See, he's talking about his Christ return and how he's going to put down all these armies and the nations that are at war with him, and then he's going to set up his millennial kingdom right there in Jerusalem, which is this. It's talking about these two different events in the psalm that we're reading right there in Psalm 76. But also, I always go back to what it says, like, for example, when Christ returns, it says in Revelation chapter 6, it says that, and I looked, and when he broke the sixth seal, and there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth made of hair, and the whole moon became like blood. And it says the stars of the heavens fell to the earth as a fig tree cast its unripe figs when shaken by a great wind, and the sky was split apart like a scroll when it is rolled up, and every mountain and every island were moved out of its places. Then the kings of the earth and the great men and the commanders and the rich and the strong and every slave and free man hid themselves in the caves and among the rocks of the mountains, and they said to the mountains and to the rocks, fall upon us and hide us from the presence of him who sits upon the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb, for the great day of their wrath has come, and who is able to stand? And is talking about here when Christ returns, but also when Christ returns, it says in Revelation chapter 14, it talks about this Armageddon, when Christ is going to come back and slay all these wicked people. It says in Revelation chapter 14, it says this, and another angel, the one who had power over fire, came out from the altar, and he called with a loud voice to him who had the sharp sickle, saying, put in your sharp sickle and gather the clusters from the vine of the earth, because her grapes are ripe. So the angel swung his sickle to the earth and gathered the clusters from the vine of the earth and threw them into the great wine press of the wrath of God. And the wine press was trodden outside the city, and blood came out from the wine press up to a horse's bridle for a distance of 200 miles. Now, what is that referring to?
The blood.
It's, what is it referring to, though? It's referring to the Battle of Armageddon. I was just reading there in Joel, multitudes and multitudes in the Valley of Decision. And God is going to bring all nations down there to Israel, down there to Jerusalem. And he's going to judge them there. All right? And when Christ comes back with great power and great glory, you know, it says in Revelation 19, and I saw the heavens open, and behold, a white horse, and he who sat upon it is called Faithful and True. And in righteousness he judges and wages war. His eyes are a flame of fire, and on his head are many diadems, and he has a name written on him which no one knows except himself. He is clothed with a robe dipped in blood, and his name is called the Word of God. And the armies which are in heaven, clothed in fine linen, white and clean, were following him on white horses, and from his mouth comes a sharp sword, so that with it he may strike down the nations, and he will rule them with a rod of iron, and he treads the winepress of the fierce wrath of Almighty God. And I just ask you, what is the winepress? Because we're reading about that over and over again. The winepress is Armageddon. Alright? That's when all these nations are going to be down there, and Christ is going to come and judge them. And what is he going to do? A sharp two-edged sword is going to come out of his mouth. He's going to speak the word and expunge every last drop of blood out of their veins. And you're going to have an army down there. I just read it here in Revelation 14 where it says, I didn't read it in that portion, but in Revelations it tells us that there's going to be at least 200 million men from the east. I'm talking about China, Cambodia, Vietnam, Laos, probably India, Pakistan. They're all coming over to Israel. But then you're probably going to have a similar armies all from the west, and you're going to have almost a half a billion men down there. And if you've got the average person has about 6 quarts of blood coursing through his veins, and you have all that blood just expunged out of your body, it's going to form a, a river of blood for 200 miles. See, this is what's going to happen when Christ returns. It's going to be absolutely, totally gruesome. But when he comes back in this great power and great glory, when every eye is going to see him, what are the Jews going to do when they see him coming back? What are they going to do?
Zechariah says that they're going to say, wow, this is the one that we crucified. He's going to show them his hands. And his
Yeah. Well, you've got it. But this is what it says in Zechariah. It says this in Zechariah 12. It says this about Christ's returns. Thus declares the Lord, who stretches out the heavens and lays the foundations of the earth and forms the spirit of man within him. Behold, I am going to make Jerusalem a cup that causes reeling to all the peoples around. And when the siege is against Jerusalem, it will also be against Judah. And we're just talking about Judah and Jerusalem, right? In this Psalm 76. It says, and it will come about in that day that I will make Jerusalem a heavy stone, and for all the peoples, and all who lift it will be severely injured, and all the nations of the earth will be gathered against it. I'm going to read that again. God says all the nations of the earth, including this one, is going to be gathered against Israel. And that day, declares the Lord, I will strike every horse with bewilderment and his rider with madness, but I will watch over the house of Judah while I strike every horse of the peoples with blindness. And then it goes on to say in this Zechariah chapter 12, it says this: in that day the Lord will defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and the one who is feeble among them in that day will be like David, and the house of David will be like God and like the angel of the Lord before him. In that day I will set about to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. Now listen to what he's going to do. When the Jews see him coming back, great power, great glory, it says this: and I will pour out on the house of David and on the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and supplication, so that they will look upon me whom they have pierced, and they will mourn for him as one mourns for an only son, and they will weep bitterly over him like the bitter weeping of a firstborn. And that day there will be great mourning in Jerusalem, like the mourning of Hadadarim in the plains of Megiddo, and the land will mourn, every family by itself. And it mentions all these families are going to mourn. Well, when they see Christ coming, great power, great glory, they're going to cry out to Christ. They're going to recognize him as being their Messiah. And it says they're going to weep over him as one weeps for an only son. What does that mean? Well, put it this way. Let's just say that you were out there with your son, 7, 8, 10, 12, whatever, and you were out hunting one day, and then you accidentally mistook him for a deer in a thicket, and you shot and killed him. Now, how are you going to feel? Oh, yawn, sorry about that. I mean, how are you going to feel? I mean, you are going to be beating yourself up. You are going to be absolutely overwhelmed with remorse, kicking yourself, saying, how could I possibly have mistaken my son for an animal? Now, the Jews, when they see Christ coming, they're going to be beating themselves up just like that. How could we possibly have mistook our Messiah for a charlatan? And it lists there, they're all going to be weeping. And it's not going to be crocodile tears either. And Jesus Christ himself said on that Palm Sunday, a week before he died, he said that he is not going to return until his people say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. And this is what it says in Zechariah. It says this in Zechariah 14, and the Lord will be king over all the earth. In that day the Lord will be the only one, and his name will be the only one, and all the land will be changed into a plain. And then it goes on to say this: now this is the plague which the Lord will strike all the peoples who have gone to war against Jerusalem. Their flesh will rot while they stand on their feet, and their eyes will rot in their sockets, and their tongue will rot in their mouth. Now, I've always looked at this as being a type of nuclear destruction. But it also could just very well be that what I was just talking about there, when Christ speaks the word, and then every last drop of blood is expunged out of their mouth, because it says this: now this is the plague which the Lord will strike the peoples who have gone to war against Jerusalem. All right? All these armies. Their flesh will rot while they stand on their feet. In other words, this isn't a wasting disease, man. They're not sick in bed somewhere. They're walking along, and their eyes will rot in their sockets, and their tongue will rot in their mouths. And it will come about in that day that a great panic from the Lord will fall upon them, and they will seize one another's hand, and the hand of one will be lifted up against another. I mean, I really could go on and on, but this is what's going to happen when Jesus Christ returns. I always refer to this because it really, really is going to happen. It's going to happen in a very, very near future. When you read in Jeremiah, when Jesus Christ is returning, it says this, therefore you shall prophesy against them all these words, and you shall say to them, the Lord will roar from on high and utter his voice from his holy habitation. He will roar mightily against his fold. He will shout like those who tread the grapes against all the inhabitants of the earth. I'm going to repeat that. That's Jeremiah chapter 25. Against all the inhabitants of the earth, a clamor has come to the end of the earth because the Lord has a controversy with the nations. That's plural. He is entering into judgment with all flesh. As for the wicked, he has given them to the sword, declares the Lord. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, behold, evil is going forth from nation to nation, and a great storm is being stirred up from the remotest parts of the earth. Is that not what's happening today? I'm going to read that again, because that's just pick up the paper, man. Just watch the news. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, behold, evil is going forth from nation to nation. Would you say that's happening today? And a great storm is being stirred up from the remotest parts of the earth. Now listen to this. Those slain by the Lord on that day will be from one end of the earth to the other. They will not be lamented or gathered or buried. They will be like dung on the face of the ground. And you could take that literally. When God says they will be like dung on the face of the ground, because Jesus Christ said, where the corpses are, the vultures will gather. And right there in Revelation chapter 19, where I was just reading about Christ's return, it says that there was an angel standing in the sun, calling forth all the birds from mid heaven to come and feast upon these corpses of these men that were at war with God. It says this, I saw an angel standing in the sun, and he cried out with a loud voice, saying to all the birds which fly in mid heaven, come and assemble for the great supper of God. So that you may eat the flesh of kings, and the flesh of commanders, and the flesh of mighty men, and the flesh of horses, and those who sit upon them, and the flesh of all men, both free and men, and slaves, small and great. And then he says, I saw the beast, which is the Antichrist, and the kings of the earth, and their armies assembled to make war against him who sat on the horse, and against his army. This is going to be the absolute, utter act of insanity when men see God coming and they're going to start firing their guns at him. People say, where are you getting that? Well, I'll just read this again. I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies assembled to make war against him. See, this world is really in for a world of hurt before it's all over and done and finishing through. But this Psalm 76, it's talking about all this in regards to Christ's return and regards to him setting up his millennial kingdom. But before that kingdom is set up, this world is going to experience incredible, incredible judgments. It's just mind-boggling what this world is going to experience when he returns. And in that Isaiah chapter 24, remember what it says is going to happen there when he does return with great power and great glory. It says that people are going to be looking at him. It says this, they raise their voices, they shout for joy, they cry out from the west concerning the majesty of the Lord. This is when Christ is returning. There's going to be two classes of people and only two classes of people. You know, there's going to be those who have given their life to him, and they're going to be absolutely ecstatic seeing him return. All right, and then there's going to be those who are going to be trying to hide from him, and those who are at war with him. And it says, therefore glorify the Lord in the east, the name of the Lord, the God of Israel, in the coastlands of this sea. From the ends of the earth we hear songs, glory to the righteous one. But I say, woe to me, alas for me, for the treacherous deal treacherously, and the treacherous deal very treacherously. Terror and pit and snare confront your inhabitants of the earth. Then it will be that he who flees the report of disaster will fall into a pit, and he who climbs out of the pit will be caught in a snare. For the windows above are opened, and the foundations of the earth shake. The earth is broken asunder, the earth is split through, the earth is shaken violently, the earth reels to and fro like a drunkard, and it totters like a shack, for its transgression is heavy upon it, and it will fall and never rise again. So it will happen in that day that the Lord will punish the hosts of heaven on high. Those are all the demons he's going to deal with, and the kings of the earth on the earth. And then it just says, then the moon will be abashed and the sun will be ashamed, for the Lord of hosts will reign on Mount Zion and Jerusalem, and his glory will be before his elders. Again, that's going back to Psalm 76. It really is. It covers so much ground, right? But it's talking about this time when things are going to be so bad that even the earth is going to be swaying to and fro like a drunkard, and it's going to totter like a shack, and everything on earth is going to crumble. Everything. I don't care. Everything's coming down in this massive earthquake. It's all coming down. I don't care whether it's the Sears Tower or the Golden Gate Bridge or the pyramids of Egypt, the Eiffel Tower. Just name it. Everything's coming down. Every superstructure man has built, it's all coming down. You see, this is the end of the world. And the sun's going to go out in my opinion, it'll be out for 3 days. And at the very end, when it seems like the whole world, there's no hope for anybody, that not even a cockroach is going to survive, that's when Jesus Christ is going to return. Great power, great glory. That's when the sky is going to split open like a scroll. People are going to see him coming. And they are going to either be absolutely, utterly terrified, or they are going to be absolutely, totally ecstatic. But when he does come, what are the people going to do who have not given their life to Christ? What are they going to be doing and saying? I'm not talking about the armies down there in Armageddon, but what are they going to be doing?
Asking the rocks to fall on them.
Yeah, because it says this in Isaiah chapter 2, enter the rock and hide in the dust from the terror of the Lord and the splendor of his majesty. The proud look of man will be abased and the loftiness of man will be humbled, and the Lord alone will be exalted in that day. For the Lord of hosts will have a day of reckoning against everyone who is proud and lofty, against everyone who is lifted up, that he may be abased. And then it goes on to just say this, in this Isaiah chapter 2, the pride of man will be humbled and the loftiness of man will be abased, and the Lord alone will be exalted in that day. But the idols will completely vanish. Men will go into the caves of the rocks and into the holes of the ground before the terror of the Lord and the splendor of his majesty, when he arises to make the earth tremble. In that day men will cast away to the moles and to the bats their idols of silver and their idols of gold, which they have made for themselves to worship, in order to go into the caverns of the rocks and the clefts of the cliffs before the terror of the Lord and the splendor of his majesty, when he rises to make the earth tremble. So stop regarding man, whose breath of life is in his nostrils, for why should he be esteemed? I mean, like I said, there's literally hundreds and hundreds of prophecies that I could cite, but we just don't have time. But that's what I'm saying. That's why I ask you right up front, these 12 verses, this Psalm 76, what is it dealing with? Well, if you realize this is dealing with Christ's return, this is dealing with his second coming, this is dealing with the end of the world, this is dealing with when he sets up his millennial kingdom, this is dealing when the remnant of the Jews are going to give their life to him, and this is when he's going to be ruling and reigning. That's what it's talking about here. That in verse 3, there he broke the flaming arrows, the shield and the sword and the weapons of war. That's when he does it, right? He's going to put an end to it. And then he said this in that verse 4 of Psalm 76, you are resplendent. Resplendent means brilliantly, you know, shiny, glorious, right? That's what that means. You are resplendent, more majestic than the mountains of prey. The stout-hearted were plundered. They sank into sleep. In other words, they were killed, right? And none of the warriors could use his hands. In other words, this is what is going to happen when Christ returns. This is what it's referring to. And I just read you all these different scripture verses to back this up. And in verse 6, at your rebuke, O God of Jacob, both the rider and the horse were cast into a deep sleep. In other words, they were killed. You, even you, are to be feared. Who may stand in your presence when once you are angry? See, that's the thing. Christ is coming back. What does his eyes look like?
His eyes?
Yes.
Fire.
Like a flame of fire. What does that denote?
Judgment.
Holiness.
Anger.
Anger. That he's angry. You can see everything in the eyes. The eyes are the window of the soul. You could see boredom. I see you guys are bored with me. You know, you could see anger. You could see sympathy. You could see, just throw it out there.
Will the anger that he has in his eyes cause him to sin?
No, this is righteous anger, believe me. But here's the thing. There's an old saying. Beware of the fury of a patient man. And there's no more patient man in the universe than Jesus Christ. But when he stands up, it says it in that verse 7, you, even you, are to be feared. And who may stand in your presence once you are angry? I'm telling you, that's what this deals with. It's dealing with his return. Verse 8, you caused judgment to be heard from heaven. The earth feared and was still. In other words, he's coming from heaven, but the heavens and the earth are going to really exhibit just incredible signs. Like Christ himself said, that there'll be signs in the heavens. And when the sun goes out and the stars are blackened, and Jesus Christ said in the Gospel of Luke that men's hearts will be failing them because of fear of the things to come, because the moon is going to turn blood red. I mean, all these things are going to happen, man. And in verse 9 it says, and when God arose to judgment to save all the humble of the earth. See that? That's dealing with his return. I just read all these scripture verses. When God arose to judgment to save all the humbles of the earth. And what did Jesus Christ say? He said this, unless these days are shortened, that no flesh would be saved. But for the sake of the elect, he will cut these days short. Now, what does that mean?
For the sake of those who put their trust in him.
Yes. Otherwise, if he does not cut these days short, and if he does not return, nobody would survive what's coming. Nobody. Not even a cockroach is going to survive. But for the sake of the people who have given their life to him, he's going to return and rescue them. And in verse 10, for the wrath of man shall praise you, and with the remnant of wrath you will gird yourself. Now when it says the wrath of man will praise him, what does that mean?
Mine says, surely your wrath against men brings you praise.
So read that again.
Surely your wrath against men brings you praise.
Yeah, but it also means for the wrath of man shall praise you. In other words, when men turn their guns on Christ, his wrath is going to destroy them. But in his putting down the wicked and destroying the wicked from the earth, you know, he is going to be praised and he is going to be exalted. Right? Even in judgment, God is going to be glorified. Even in judgment, because people are going to see his righteous judgment. And in verse 11 it says, make vows to the Lord your God and fulfill them. Let all who are around him bring gifts to him who is to be feared. Now this is what's going to happen when?
Can you back up for a second?
Yeah.
What? You clarified the first part of verse 10 for me, but I didn't get the second part.
Okay, verse 10 says, for the wrath of man shall praise you. In other words, God is going to be glorified even in judgment. All right, okay. When men turn their guns on him. And with the remnant of wrath, you will gird yourself. In other words, he's going to gird himself in righteous anger. What is your saying?
Okay, the second part of my verse 10 says, and the survivors of your wrath are restrained.
Read it again.
Okay, the whole thing says, surely your wrath against men brings you praise, and the survivors of your wrath are restrained.
Well, the survivors of his wrath, what that would suggest to me is what? When he does return, there's going to be two classes of people. Well, it's the people who give their life to him that are not going to come under his judgment. But remember, Jesus Christ said in Matthew 25, he said that when he does return, and his feet are going to touch down on the Mount of Olives, he's going to go into Jerusalem. It says that he's going to set up his glorious throne there, but he says he's going to send his angels all through the earth. And they're going to bring all the survivors throughout the entire earth, whether they're saved or whether they're lost. And they're going to bring them down to Jerusalem. And Christ is going to separate the sheep from the goats on the basis of, I was hungry, I was thirsty, I was sick, I was naked, I was a prisoner, I was a stranger, what'd you do for me? And the ones on his left, the goats on his left, he's going to slay with his mouth. And they are going to go to hell to wait the great white throne judgment. But the remnant, he's going to clothe himself in righteous judgment. And then there is going to be a remnant of people who are going to go into his kingdom. In other words, even in his wrath, he's going to exert mercy, all right, on the people who have given their life to him and the people who have survived and the Jews that are calling out to him when he does return. All right? Now, anybody have anything you want to add to that chapter 76?
We didn't go through 11 and 12.
When I said it in that verse 11, make vows to the Lord your God and fulfill them, let all who are around him bring gifts to him who is to be feared. Now, when is that going to happen?
Millennial period.
During the millennial period. That's what I'm saying. This is what this is dealing with. It's dealing with his return, all right, with the destruction of this world, and then he's going to set up his millennial kingdom, and then when he sets up his kingdom, this is the fulfillment of this verse 11. And in verse 12, he says, he will cut off the spirit of princes, or basically the politicians, the leaders. He is feared by the kings of the earth. In other words, what is the spirit of these princes? Look at the world leaders today. Look at the decisions that they're making. Are they making godly decisions? Are they making decisions that are based upon God's word and obedience to God and honoring God? No, every stinking thing they come up with. Yes. And then he's going to cut off this spirit, all right? And, the kings of the earth are going to fear him. And I was just reading there in Isaiah chapter 2 and Revelation chapter 6, man, the kings of the earth, They're going to see him coming, and they're going to be trying to hide, calling to the mountains and the hills to fall upon them, to crush them into oblivion. Yeah, and you got to be pretty darn scared if you want a mountain to fall on top of you. I mean, I would say, wouldn't you? Right? Well, let's just quickly go through this chapter 77. I won't spend nearly as much time on commenting upon this chapter, but I'll just break it down. I won't read the whole thing, but it says this in verse 1.
And that's because it's a comforting psalm?
Yeah, well, in a way, maybe it is, but it says in verse 1, my voice rises to God, and I will cry aloud. My voice rises to God, and he will hear me. In the day of my trouble, I sought the Lord. In the night, my hand was stretched out without weariness. My soul refused to be comforted. When I remember God, then I am disturbed. When I sigh, then my spirit grows faint. You have held my eyelids open. I am so troubled that I cannot speak. I have considered the days of old, the years of long ago. I will remember my song in the night, and I will meditate with my heart, and my spirit ponders. Will the Lord reject forever, and will he never be favorable again? Has his loving kindness ceased forever? Has his promise come to an end forever? Has God forgotten to be gracious, or has he in his anger withdrawn his compassion? Then I said, it is my grief that the right hand of the Most High has changed. I shall remember the deeds of the Lord. Surely I will remember your wonders of old. Now, before I go any further, I just wanted to, just comment briefly upon what's happening here. And who could tell me in a nutshell what is taking place here in just the 10 verses that we read, basically?
He's feeling really distressed.
Good. And what is that prompting him to do?
Well, he's just wondering where is God in his circumstance.
Search for the Lord.
Look for God.
Yes. Okay. Verse 1. My voice rises to God, and I will cry aloud. My voice rises to God, and he will hear me. In the day of my trouble, I sought the Lord. In the night, my hand was stretched out without weariness. My soul refused to be comforted. Now, here's the thing. What David is saying here, or the writer of the psalm is saying, and it's basically, has to do with us too, is that this soul is really, really crying out to God. He's really trying to seek God. He's really praying to God with a great deal of intensity. But what's really motivating this soul to do that?
Grief.
Trouble, grief, trial, disappointment, heartbreak, disillusionment. I mean, just throw it out there. This is the problem with us. This is the problem with mankind. It really is that if people's lives are halfway satisfactory to themselves and basically going along okay, what are the chances they are going to really seek God with intensity?
Not very high.
Not too many people do that, do they? I know that there's some people that do it. They don't need a fire lit under their hiney before they finally get serious with God. But they are really few. Right? Look at Job. I mean, here's a classic example. And other people that you can see in the Bible, right? They just sought God with all their heart, all their mind, all their soul, all their strength when everything was going their way. But I tell you what, usually what happens is that people do not seek God with that kind of intensity unless something really caves in around their ears. Let's just say, for example, you're going along. You're not living a wicked life, but your relationship with God is all yawn. I go to church twice a year, man, and that's really a drag to even do that much. I mean, we just had Easter, man, and it's like, oh, I just got to hold my tongue. I can't find a place to park. And it's like, where are all these big fish the rest of the year? Well, I'm not trying to be anybody's judge, but I think, doggone it, these people need to take God serious. You know what I mean? And instead of shying a pew with their rear end twice a year, that's not taking God serious. But now, how many of these people, let's just say, that just go to church twice a year, or they can't give God the time of day for the whole week long, let's just say now they go to the doctor and they find out, man, you got cancer. And now this is really going to be painful and distressing and, life-threatening. Now, how are you going to seek God now?
Every minute of every day.
Oh, now you've got something. Now you're really, really motivated, aren't you? Let's just say it's your loved one. Let's just say it's your child that comes down sick, Or let's just say any number of things, just throw it out there that really, really make our world cave in on us. That's what's happening here. Look at this, verse 1. My voice rises to God, and I will cry aloud. My voice rises to God, and He will hear me. In the day of my trouble, I sought the Lord. See, that's the thing, right? But how many people seek the Lord when they're not really hard-pressed? See, that's the thing.
Even so, there are that's a point in time when you will do one of two things. You will seek God, or you will reject God even more.
Yes, a very good point. All right. Now, that's why, when we were reading the previous chapter, I read all about the return of Christ and, the end of the world and everything that's going to be happening there. But we read in Revelation chapter 7 and Revelation chapter 14 about these 144,000 who go forth and they convert the world in this very, very short period of time, in this 7-year period of time. But we are told in chapter 7 of Revelation that there's a multitude, just a multitude of people that come out of this great tribulation period, and they're martyred, they're killed in this tribulation period. And it says that they've washed their robes in the blood of the Lamb, and they are standing in heaven with palm branches in their hands and singing praises to God. And then the elder asked John, the Apostle John, who are these? And John said, well, I don't know. And he says, well, these are the ones who came out of the great tribulation, and they washed their robes in the blood of the Lamb. You know, and they served God day and night. In other words, how many of these people would make it to heaven if it weren't for the great tribulation? You know what I mean? That's why I always refer to the tribulation period as the great merciful tribulation, because believe it or not, people are going to suffer immeasurably. This world is really going to be hurting. But it's in people's pain and their suffering that they're going to cry out to God, and they're going to give their life to God. You see what I'm saying? So God in His great mercy is going to light a fire under this world. He just is. And then in verse 3, when I remember God, then I am disturbed. When I sigh, then my spirit grows faint. You have held my eyelids open. I am so troubled that I cannot speak. Now it's basically saying, man, he's really seeking God, and he's really intensely seeking God in prayer. But his prayers aren't answered overnight, lickety split. I mean, we all like to have our prayers answered right now or yesterday, or, you know, it's our way or the highway. But I tell you what, God will allow us to go through periods of real struggle or disappointment or heartbreak or blackness or whatever, because it presses us into knowing nobody but God. That's what's happening here. In verse 5, I have considered the days of old, the years of long ago. I will remember my song in the night. I will meditate with my heart, and my spirit ponders. In other words, in the midst of all of his troubles, he may wonder, well, where's God in this? But if he looks back on times in his life when God was there for him, it becomes an encouragement. It becomes a comfort to him. But also just looking back on their history, when God delivered the Jewish people, I don't care whether it was from Pharaoh or from their enemies, or, you know, he's a God that can always be trusted, even if he's delays in his response or his answering our prayers. Verse 7, will the Lord reject forever? Will he never be favorable again? I mean, have you ever been there wondering, man, where's God in this situation? He seems to be as silent as a tomb, and things are going from bad to worse. Well, that's the time when you really got to dig in your heels and say, well, you know, God's too good to be unkind, too wise to make mistakes, and I'm just going to trust Him in this and continue to seek His face in this. You know, and in verse 8, has His loving kindness ceased forever? Has His promise come to an end forever? Has God forgotten to be gracious, or has His anger withdrawn compassion? Then I said, it is my grief that the right hand of the Most High has changed. I shall remember the deeds of the Lord. Surely I will remember your wonders of old. See, this is the thing. He can get to the point where he's just wondering, man, has God turned on me? Has his nature changed? No. You go back and you just read about what he's done in the past. And that's how your faith will grow. That's how your confidence in him will deepen. And in verse 12, I will meditate on all your work and muse on your deeds. This is what people need to do in their times of real trouble. You know, I seek the Lord with intensity, but then remember that He's too good to be unkind, too wise to make mistakes, and you can just read His Word over and over again and see time and time and time again how He will answer the prayers of the righteous, and that He will sustain them. And in verse 13, your way, O God, is holy. What God is great like our God? You are the God who works wonders. You have made known your strength among the peoples. You have by your power redeemed your people, the sons of Jacob and Joseph. The waters saw you, O God, the waters saw you. They were in anguish. The deeps also trembled. The clouds poured out water. The skies gave forth a sound. Your arrows flashed here and there. The sound of your thunder was in the whirlwind. The lightning lit up the world. The earth trembled and shook. Your way was in the sea, and your paths in the mighty waters. Your footprints may not be known. You led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. In other words, in this Saul's real distress, he's thinking back to a time where God delivered his people, Israel, you know, from the hand of Pharaoh, and how he delivered them through the Red Sea. And I was just talking about last chapter, chapter 76, how it talked about the end of the world. But I'm telling you what, everything that happened, you know, there when God delivered his people from the hand of Pharaoh, or from the heel of Pharaoh, that's going to repeat itself. It's going to repeat itself, you know, when Christ returns. All right? You just look back on past history, because what happened? What was the first plague that God sent against Egypt?
Nile to blood.
Turned to Nile to blood, and all the fresh water was turned to blood. Even the water that was stored in cisterns and pots and pans or whatever, it all turned to blood. Well, it's going to happen again on a global scale. We are told in Revelation 16 that all the sea is going to be turned to blood, and all the fresh water is going to be turned to blood. Also, the frogs. That was a curse that was brought upon the Egyptians. They just couldn't even take a step without squish, squish, crunch, crunch. I mean, there's frogs everywhere, right? Well, in Revelations chapter 16, we're talking about demons that look like frogs are going to go forth and...
Oh, that's gross.
You guys have never read that?
Demons that look like frogs?
Yes, in Revelation chapter 16. You don't? Well, where you been all these years? How many years you been coming to the
Bible?
Huh?
And it was good.
Okay, it says Revelation 16. And I saw coming out of the mouth of the dragon, and out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet, three unclean spirits like frogs. For they are spirits of demons performing signs which go out to the kings of the whole world to gather them together for the war of the great day of God the Almighty. What war? Armageddon. But these demons, they look like frogs, and they go forth to all these different kings of the earth, to the nations of the earth, and they stir them up, saying, hey, Israel's your problem. You got to get down there and destroy them. But these demons look like frogs. You guys need to read the Bible. No, you can't see them, but John saw them. And also, in Exodus, we read about the third plague was the gnats, the fourth plague was the flies. Well, in Revelation, it talks about pestilence. Would you call that pestilence? They couldn't even take a breath without inhaling flies or gnats. Oh my God, that's quite a judgment. And they also the cattle. In other words, in Joel, we're told at the end of the world, even all the animals are going to suffer immeasurably of what's coming. And then there was boils upon the Egyptians. Well, what's coming upon everybody that takes the mark? You know, these malignant sores are going to break out upon the men who take the mark. Also, the hail mixed with fire, that's going to come at the end of the world too. The hail mixed with fire. But how big is this hail going to be at the end of the world? It's going to be hailstones, 100 pounds each. And that will be generated, I believe, by nuclear war, because when these atomic weapons go off, they form that mushroom cloud. In other words, they push out the atmosphere with the explosion, then come back with tremendous force, and push all this hot air and this debris up into the stratosphere, and it collides with that freezing cold air, and then it comes down in huge chunks of ice or just torrential rainstorms. And now when that happens too, the sun's gone out. So that atmosphere is going to be so freezing cold, and when it collides with all this hot air, that's when you're going to have what? Hail mixed with fire again. You know, 100-pound hailstones mixed with what? Nuclear fires, right? That's coming upon the world. Then there's locusts, all right? We are told in Exodus that there was never a greater horde of locusts ever witnessed before, and it ever would happen afterwards. But what do we read in Revelation chapter 9? We read how these demons are let loose out of hell, that they've been down there. And my belief is that these are fallen seraphim. They got the body of horses, they got the face of men, they got the teeth of lions, they got the hair of women, they got gold crowns on their head, they got wings that flap so loud they sound like many chariots wrestling in the battle, and they got tails like scorpions. And I believe these are demonic seraphim. All right, that are unleashed from the bowels of hell, but nobody sees them. but they will inflict a plague, a pandemic upon the world where men will long to die and they'll seek to die, but they won't be able to die. See, this is supernatural, but these are John said they look like locusts, but he says they come out of this great furnace that's just bellowing out with all this smoke. And this is my belief, it's my contention, okay, I'm just making an educated guess based upon everything that I read, is that it's going to coincide with a super volcano. Men are going to see a volcano somewhere in this world, but what they're not going to see is all these demons from hell that are unleashed that come out of this, out of the bottomless pit, all right, that's locust, and then there's going to be darkness. How long did the darkness last in Egypt?
3 days.
3 days. Now, we're not told in Revelation and other portions of Scripture, there's at least a dozen, probably 14, 16 places in Scripture where we are told that the world is going to be plunged into darkness, that the sun is going to go out. And I believe it's going to be for 3 days. And it's at the end of that 3 days when everything seems totally lost, that the sky is going to open up and everybody's going to see Christ coming. But then there's also the death of the firstborn. Well, we're told in Isaiah chapter 13 that God said, I'm going to make mortal man scarcer than gold, scarcer than the pure gold of Ophir. All right? So, like I said, when we're reading this type of thing, and you're reading about what? You're reading about what happened back there in Egypt. This is what this soul was doing. It's going back, and he's basically meditating in his heart and his mind of what God did in the past to show his mighty power. All right, and he's going to put his confidence in God, because that's what it says. Like in verse 16, the waters saw you, O God, the waters saw you. They were in anguish, the deeps also trembled. He's talking about how Moses split that Red Sea. But then all the Egyptian army was drowned in that Red Sea. But now, when Christ returns, there's going to be another Red Sea of what?
Men's blood.
Men's blood. They're going to be drowning in another Red Sea, their own blood. The clouds poured out water, the sky gave forth a sound, the arrows flashed, and here and there, that's what the lightning, right? And the hail mixed with fire. The sound of your thunder was in the whirlwind, and the lightning lit up the world. The earth trembled and shook. This is what's going to happen at the end of the world. And then verse 19, your way was in the sea, your path in the mighty waters, and your footprints may not be known. In other words, God, you know, he does all these marvelous, powerful, incredible things, and nobody can explain it, right? And you led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. And that's going to happen when Christ comes back, because Moses was a type of Christ, right? And he said, by the hand of Moses and Aaron. Well, Moses, you know, was their leader. Well, when Christ comes back, he's going to be king and priest, right? He's going to be that mediator. Now, that's what I'm saying. It's easy to read a psalm and have it go in one ear and out the other over our head. If you don't see the theme. But once you get the theme, then you could put it all together. And it all is pointing to Christ. Anybody have anyone to add or share?
No.